So how much are the Green Bay Packers worth to you? We'll talk about a green and gold stock offering and a whole lot more during this edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, October the 25th. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley is in, and he will answer your personal finance questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So, what's new?
Back up in the Eau Claire area after a lovely few days down in Madison, where I was fortunate enough to spend some time at the plush and luxurious Wisconsin Public Radio studios with you and Rob and all the other nice people down there. So
it was a pleasure having you here in Madison, and you did walk away with the coveted WPR auto magnet as well.
Yeah, I actually walked away with a couple purses and wallets from the employee lounge.
That's
too,
where so. That went.
Yeah, now you know.
All right. Anyway, if you want to see a picture of Kevin in our plush studios with his auto magnet, you can go to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I have posted that up there. I've decided not to keep it as blackmail, Kevin, so it's there for everyone to see. So, anyway.
What are you implying? That just a simple random picture of me can be used as blackmail?
No, it was a fine picture. Let's talk about the Packers. That was a great game on Sunday, wasn't it?
It was an interesting game, and the team is the defending Super Bowl champions, and just apparently there's no way they can be beat ever. As long as Aaron Rodgers is vertical, I think that the team is unstoppable.
And I might be able to buy some stock in the team soon.
Yeah, just don't plan on ever really selling it or making any money on it. They are having a new issue, has just been approved by the NFL. Still needs some more legal and regulatory approval as well, but this is the fifth time that the Green Bay Packers have given people an option to join the 112,000 shareholders who own about 5 million shares in the team. They're going to use the proceeds to help with $143 million in renovations to Lambeau Field. They haven't set the price yet for the shares, but in 1997, it was $200 per share. They offered 400,000 shares at that time. About 120,000 shares were subscribed. It doesn't have any dividends. It generally can't be sold, although there is a certificate from that 97 offering on eBay right now, and the current bid is about $250. So apparently some people are willing to sell it, and if because the laws of supply and demand, they might actually make a little money on it. The perks are that you get to vote on issues affecting the team, you get to attend the annual meetings, and according to Packers.com website, you get a chance to purchase exclusive Packers shareholder merchandise.
Ooh.
So, yeah, it's a very nice perk that you get a chance to buy more stuff. But the share offering does draw some greater public attention to what is one of the most unique organizations in business and Wisconsin and in all of sports.
How so? What do you mean?
Well, for starters, they are a for-profit nonprofit. According to Wisconsin law, nonprofits can't issue shares of stock in their organization. So they have to be a for-profit, but they're a nonprofit in the sense that they are not owned in the traditional manner. Also, the league ownership rules don't allow this structure anymore for current NFL teams who are not the Green Bay Packers. Green Bay was grandfathered in when they changed the law several years ago. And also, the Green Bay Packers are the only professional sports organization in America to publicize its financial information, which they have to do because they have a lot of shareholders. And that can have some dramatic ramifications for labor issues and for political issues.
Does this sale of stock indicate that the Packers are in need of money or something?
More that they want money rather than they're in need of it. They have about a $96 million in revenue from last year, and most of that comes from a great TV contract. But they also have the legendary loyal season ticket holders, 295 straight sellouts, and there are about 80,000 people on the waiting list, which is actually more than can hold at Lambeau Field. They get a ton of extra revenue from that merchandising and their licensing and the facilities income that they get from Lambeau Field. what it really comes down to is they've been very fortunate that for going back two decades now, they've had at the helm one of the best quarterbacks in the league for 20 years and who has been very healthy. So that tends to win games and tends to increase fan loyalty. Plus, you got two Super Bowl championships, and who knows, they might see another one this year as well.
Yeah, it could be. Do you see any possibility of the team's status changing?
You mean like could they ever be sold or moved or
any of that? Yeah,
yeah. I suppose it's possible, and you only have to talk with some fans who might still be living from the Packers' former brethren back in the 20s or 30s in places like Muncie or Flint or Toledo, who had teams that were just as good or as strong as the Green Bay Packers, but they're gone, and the Packers are still here. If they had a losing team and they tried to still charge the higher prices, or the team had a lot of losses, it would be difficult to see who might actually absorb the losses. But even if the team were sold to somebody else, the money goes not to the local American Legion post. That was changed several years ago. Now it goes to the Green Bay Packers Foundation. Hard to see in this environment where the team would actually be moved if it were sold, and I'm guessing if it were the next day, there'd be a huge movement to get the Green Bay Packer name back and start up a new franchise.
Yeah. So are you a shareholder, Kevin, or thinking about it?
I am not. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple other better places to put my money. Although it does, I think it's a great organization, especially from the structure standpoint, and it really does. Fans of many other teams are very envious of the organization and the way that they're not held hostage by a greedy owner every single 7 years or so for a new stadium and not always being threatened to move to Las Vegas or Nome, Alaska.
Yeah. Any idea what kind of special merchandise I might be able to buy that as a shareholder as a schmuck like I am?
Well, let's just be honest. There are plenty of schmucks who are Packer shareholders. It's not mutually exclusive, but I think there's some certificates you can get, some frames, a 4-year certificate, etc. But it's something that's nice. And then it gives you a chance if you are a shareholder. You can always weigh in on the Packers message boards on the internet of saying, well, as a Packer shareholder, I believe that. So it's a nice little gesture. And if they come in at that $200 price range, it might make a nice holiday gift if they get all of this done by the time the end of the year rolls around. I will say that it is a little coincidental that they're coming in the wake of winning a Super Bowl and they're issuing stock. And the last time they did this, they were in the wake of winning a Super Bowl. So they're trying to sell high.
And we're talking about the end of the year when this would start?
Know. They haven't said yet for sure when the date's going to come. But I would guess that if they're smart, that's probably when they'll try to do it so people can get a last-minute Christmas gift.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for every investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin about personal finances, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time for the On Your Money email box. And Morgan sent an email. He says, on one of your past radio shows, you talked about how to form an LLC. You said it would be on your website, but I can't find anything. Kevin, where'd you put that, Kevin?
That's on purpose. We like to keep our visitor time up to a maximum there, so we purposely obfuscate and hide. It's on there someplace. Even I can't find it. But there are actually a few websites that Morgan and other people who are interested in forming an LLC or even getting some broader legal help should go to. The first one is for the LLC is WDFI.org, and that's the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. And if you are forming a corporation in Wisconsin, that body oversees the process, and it's fairly inexpensive, and it's relatively easy if you have a simple situation. But if you want to do your own research on a background basis, go to WI.org. lawlibrary.gov. That's the Wisconsin Law Library, which has a ton of information on the Wisconsin laws relating to all kinds of different legal topics. And then finally, you can have an LLC formed on kind of an automated basis, much like you might file your taxes through TurboTax by going to LegalZoom.com. And it might cost $100 to $200 to have it done. They ask you some questions automatically, fill in the blanks, and then you get printed out and you have your LLC.
Yeah, and so you think places like LegalZoom are reliable?
In terms of you're getting what you pay for, probably. I mean, the process is really where they ask you questions and you say yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, and they lead you through kind mm-hmm. of a decision tree of automating the process. But if you have a simple situation, you might want to go for that. The problem is most people's situations, especially when they're talking about forming a business and any kind of partnership, have some complexity. And if you have some complexity of the situation, you're better off spending money on a few hours with a real lawyer. I look at it as insurance, is that the money you spend with a lawyer right now is a cost, but it's insurance that you're not going to, hopefully not going to incur a much greater cost down the road because you haven't set up the proper legal framework in advance for what you're trying to do. So you could, with a lawyer, you can generally spend a few $100s now to avoid spending several $1,000s later. And hopefully, if you are working with one in setting up an LLC, you have one who has experience in this specific situation.
Yeah, and is there some place we can find an attorney that has the experience we need?
Sure. In Wisconsin, you can go to wisbar.org, W-I-S-B-A-R.org. Or you can go nationally at lawyers.com and search for an attorney not only in a specific geographic area, but one who has the type of expertise, whether it's real estate or business or legal, criminal defense, whatever. Also ask other advisors. If you know a banker or an insurance agent or a CPA or a financial planner, say, you know, I'm trying to do this. Do you know a lawyer who's in town who I should talk to who isn't going to charge me an arm and a leg but will really get done what I want to do? And by the way, all the websites that we've discussed here on Your Money will be up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah. And Kevin, remind me, the LLC, which you have after your title, and I see it all over the place, that stands for limited liability. What does that stand for?
Likes lots of chocolate, actually. I wanted to put that out there and just kind of see that, you know, I want people to know that about me. I think it's important. And
no, seriously, what does it mean?
It stands for limited liability.
Yeah.
And basically, when people say, well, I want to form an LLC, they often think, well, it's because of some kind of great tax reason. There are tax advantages to owning a business and using expenses to get tax deductions, but the LLC is really more about limiting the liability, meaning that you can find the liability to the assets of that specific business or corporation.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. This is On Your Money. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll talk about light bulbs. That's right. Kevin has some advice on some changes that are coming up with light bulbs. And we invite your questions, too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money.
We are talking about your money during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question about your money, you can also send us an email, onyourmoney@wpr.org. And we do have an open line for you, a rare open line for you, if you have a question. Jim in Wanakee joins us first. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. First of all, thank you, Kevin, for your public service here, and I appreciate this offering that you have each week. I listen to it every week, and
yeah.
Really, I like the advice you give.
Well, I appreciate that. Excuse me, Jim. I appreciate that. It's actually court-ordered, and I still have about 4 years left, so I thank you, but I wouldn't
He's
be here
kidding,
if I didn't
Jim.
Have
He's
to
kidding.
Patient, huh? Well, listen, my question is this. I'm a proud grandfather of twins, and their first birthday is coming up in December. And I'm doing some research and want to get your advice about college fund. I want to start their college fund. I'm not sure whether my daughter and son-in-law have already invested in that. I don't think they have, but anyway, they've been too busy with twins.
Mm-hmm.
But I want your advice, if you could, in terms of like a specific kind of college fund, and in particular, what I'm interested in doing for them. I'm a woodcarver, and one of the things that I heard on public radio, a biologist said that one of the best investments that you can ever make is in walnut trees, that they're worth their weight in gold. And so I was wondering if, well, first of all, the type of college fund for a one-year-old that you would recommend, and then do you know of any mutual funds or like tree plantations or someplace that might invest in walnut trees or other kind of valuable trees like that?
Wow, I've never heard that before. Walnut trees, I like walnuts. Kevin?
Well, it just goes to show you can't believe everything you hear on public radio. No, that's actually a barbell approach to this process. The first thing I would say to do, and the simplest thing to do for people who say, yeah, I don't know about trees, for grandparents, especially Jim, I'm guessing these twins have already demonstrated obvious, gifted, and talented and high potential traits.
Absolutely, I bet.
They're going to be biologists themselves, I think.
Yes, there you go. I would go with the EdVest plan for someone like you, for Wisconsin's 529 college savings plan. It allows you to keep control of the money. You set the accounts up with the grandchild as the beneficiary, but the account is still in your name. You're free to do with it whatever you want. If and when the kids need the money for college, they can pull the money out at your discretion. And if it's used for qualified higher education expenses, all the proceeds are tax-free.
It's called EdVest, A-D?
E-D. E-D-V-E-S-T .com.
Okay, I'm a little hearing impaired.
That's okay.
.com?
EdVest.com, right. You can use any state's 529 plan that you want, but the EdVest gives Wisconsin residents a small state tax break for grandparents and other closely associated relatives. And you can do whatever you want with the money. You can put it in there, and they have all the different kinds of funds, much like a 401k or 403b retirement plan has at work. And offhand, I would choose a target date fund that that is geared towards basically 17 years from now, where it starts out more aggressive now and becomes more conservative by the time the kids turn 18. So it's less likely you'll have a lot of volatility in the value in the years immediately prior to them entering college. Now, in terms of the walnut tree idea, I actually don't mind this at all, but if you have any access to land anywhere, what I'd like to see do is just plant the trees yourself and see what happens.
Oh, well, that's an idea. I don't have any land, but well, the other question I have is what about if my wife and I die? You know, you said that we would control that, or I would control mm-hmm. that. But is there a beneficiary? This thing, like.
Yep, they've already taken account our journey on this mortal coil, in that they have you become the owner of the account, and if you wish, you can set up your daughter or son-in-law as the successor owner of the account, maintaining the grandchildren as the beneficiary. So you would be the owner. Your daughter would be the successor owner, meaning if and when you die, she would take over ownership of the account. And then it's her money still to do with what she wants, but the beneficiary is set up as your grandchildren.
Okay, great.
Well, congratulations, Jim. Happy birthday to your grandchildren.
I tell you, they are really something.
Yeah. Bet you they're darling. Thanks very much for the call. And Aaron in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning, Joy. How morning. Are you?
Good. How are you, Aaron?
Good. I have a question that I've been dying to ask an advisor. I have a 401k, and now this is a decision I've already made, but I've been getting a lot of advice post-decision that makes me worry. I took the 401k and put it into a variable annuity, and my advisor told me that I'd be getting a guaranteed 6% rate of return, and there's the death benefit, and it seemed like a good thing to do with 10 years out to retirement. But other people have said the fees are too high, I'll never get the money, et cetera. I just wondered what your thoughts were, pro and con, on variable annuities.
Well, the issues that other people have raised are definitely true. That doesn't make them bad or wrong. It just adds some negatives into the equation to offset any of the positives. Where I'm concerned, and this is not an uncommon instance, is somewhere along the lines between what's in that 240-page dense prospectus that you received. You did receive a prospectus, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay, and you read it from cover to cover and parsed each and every word, correct?
No.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, you're like every other single person who's ever received a variable annuity prospectus. The problem is that 6% probably isn't guaranteed in the sense that most of us would think that. And somewhere between the prospectus and your perception, that was that was not made clear to you. And hopefully it was... the best intentions of the agent or the advisor were there. Sometimes I've seen that not, and sometimes even the agent, the advisor doesn't understand the ins and outs of these. What the 6% probably is, it means at any given time or on certain pre-established dates, you, Aaron, can say, hey, I want this money. And the insurance company that sponsors the variable annuity will annuitize it like you made 6% on it. But in the sense that if you had, let's say, $100,000, after the first year you can pull $106,000 out and do with whatever you want. Next year, 6% more on top of that, et cetera, forever and ever. That's not the case. And I can just about guarantee it's not the case based on the very scant information given me, just because it's very difficult to earn 3% on a guaranteed risk-free rate of return right now, much less 6%, much less after all the commissions and fees for the variable annuity have been paid. So it doesn't make it necessarily a bad thing. It wouldn't be my first or even second choice for what people should do with their 401k money right now, but it's not the end of the world. There are some features and benefits to it. The question is, before you make the decision with this in the future, you should know what those features and benefits are and what the costs are, and then weigh the benefits against the cost. How long ago did you take the annuity out?
It just happened. In fact,
Was he just leaving as you made the call?
No, I'm going to sign more papers right now.
Ah, okay. Then I would, first of all, before you sign any more papers, I would ask for a much further explanation of your concerns. And I would even want it to be pointed out in the prospectus where it says you're going to get 6% on your money in the sense that you understand it. And if you don't get this, and this still seems like something that's too confusing, I would wait. I think it will be there tomorrow, it will be there the day after, and it will be there the day after that, and something better might come up in the meantime. But otherwise, if you don't understand the investment and how it works and what the costs are and what the benefits are, I'm not sure it'd be something I would plunge my entire retirement savings into.
Generally, what are the benefits of doing something like this, Kevin?
It is just what Erin, not what she perceived, but what the fact is, in that, let's say the account went way down. As long as the insurance company's in business and has the ability to make these payments, she could turn around and turn a faucet on of an income stream that would be like she had earned 6% per year. But it basically is, they call it like a guaranteed retirement income base. There's all kinds of acronyms these companies use. But it's not what she understands it to be. And that's not anything wrong with Aaron. That's very common with a lot of really bright people who think they're making the right decision based on what some guy in a tie is telling them. Typically somewhere between the truth and the perception, it got clouded and lost, and it's not as good as what Aaron is perceiving it to be.
Just keeping it in the 401k is maybe a better choice, is what you're saying?
It can be if the fees are lower and the investment options are good. Some people like to have it moved over into an individual IRA so that they can control the option and have a much greater scope of where they would choose to invest it. But no, again, I don't think variable annuities are evil. I just think that they have higher expenses and the benefits are often oversold and the expenses are undersold, much like any other product that's marketed in the world.
Mm-hmm. Erin, do you have anything else?
No, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. So let's say the paperwork has been completely signed. Erin said she still had some papers to sign there. But let's say you did it and you're having second thoughts. What happens then?
I think Wisconsin still has a free look period where oftentimes people can cancel on insurance. It might be 3 days or so, 3 business days or something like that. But I would just get it clarified of what you're getting into first. And even if, let's say she had done this a year ago, well, again, it's not the end of the world. It's not like the money has disappeared off the face of the planet. And generally, variable annuities have no upfront sales charge, but they have a very high redemption charge, which means if you pull the money out within the first 6 to 10 years, you might lose somewhere between 6% and 1% of your money. And that generally reflects the sales charges and commissions and fees if you pull it out early. So again, it's not like she's lost this money. And some people have bought this kind of annuity, been very happy with it, and been completely aware of the costs and benefits, and it's worked out very well for them. So again, it's not that they're evil. It's just that I'd like her to know more about what she's getting into before she signs the rest of these papers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Aaron, for the call. Good luck. Dave in Dunn County is with us. Hello, Dave.
Hello. My mother's in her 80s. She owns two homes, and they're being rented out. They're for sale, but nobody's buying homes right now. She's going to be around for a long time, I'm sure. But is there anything we should do now as far as ownership going to the kids rather than wait until, you know, she's gone and then the state or the government will say, you've got to do this. So what's the smart thing to do now?
Well, the smart thing to do now may be nothing, especially if, like you say, she is going to live a long time. The state and the federal government probably, it's not that they say that you have to do something with them, like, you know, you have to repaint the kitchen. I can't believe you still have an avocado refrigerator in there. You're more concerned about taxes and probably about long-term care costs, right?
Right. Well, right now they're being rented out, you know, for income, and one of them's paid for, the other one's not. And, you know, she wants to see her kids get the houses, and rather than, you know, just maybe being seized for taxes, I don't know.
That's a good question. And the tax issue, though, I hope that she has an estate that is subject to estate taxes, but right now the exemption is at $5 million. So the likelihood of that happening, that she has an estate that's large enough to actually pay any taxes, it's only on the amount over $5 million as well. The likelihood of that happening is pretty small. And in terms of long-term care costs, some people say, well, I want to, you know, deplete my assets so that I can qualify for public assistance. Well, you have to generally get rid of the assets or give them to a family member at least 60 months before you enter a long-term care facility and try to qualify for public assistance. And sometimes giving an asset to a family member, a trusted one, a beloved one, is no different than, you know, burning the house to the ground in terms of the value, because it can be accidentally or purposely liquidated and spent due to a divorce or what have you. And finally, if that money goes away and she's then on public assistance with really no other options for it, at least when she has the home and the income from renting them, she has some options for it. So she's probably older than the prime target area for long-term care insurance, but I would just soon have her do nothing other than estate planning so that the value of the homes and the rest of her estate goes where she wants it. And so you want to contact a lawyer and have the estate plan written up so it goes there as quickly as possible, and that probate is as short and pain-free as possible.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much, Dave. Thanks for the call, and good luck to you. It's time now for the smart assets portion of the program. And Kevin, with Social Security recipients, retirement savers, taxpayers, we have seen some changes thanks to inflation. Is it possible that a little bit of inflation is a good thing?
Yeah, it is, especially when it comes to money that is coming in rather than money that is going out. First of all, let's start with the Social Security recipients. There are about 55 million retirees and 8 million people on Social Security disability who are going to receive a larger check, at least initially, on January 1st. There are a 3.6% increase in the payment amount. It's the first in several years, and it means that the average retiree check, which is about $1,177 per month right now, should get a nice, probably about a $40 boost on a monthly basis.
Well, that's good. What about those who want to save more for retirement?
You will be able to save more in 2012 than you can this year. 2011, the max has been raised to $500. up to $17,000 for an at-work plan and $22,500 for people who are over 50. The income ceiling also for pre-tax IRA eligibility will rise, and Roth IRAs as well. They're only up a few thousand dollars, but because these are often phase-out situations, people who are on kind of the cusp of being phased out now may be able to contribute a lot more either to a Roth or tax-deductible IRA than what they once could have.
Is saving more into a pre-tax retirement plan the only way that we can see lower taxes in 2012?
I know the good news is we'll also get bumps in the standard deduction and the income tax brackets. It's about $300 for married couples filing jointly and half that for singles. So the new standard deduction for 2012 will be $11,900 for married couples filing jointly and $5,950, half that for singles. And the 15% tax bracket numbers are also jumping up. That's one we talk about a lot. That's jumping up to $70,700 for married couples. And again, and half that, $35,350 for singles. So couples who are taking the standard deduction and are in the 25% tax bracket, in 2012, they'll pay about $300 to $400 less in federal income taxes than they were in 2011, all of the things being equal.
So what do you think, Evan? Will the higher Social Security checks and the lower tax bills help us keep up with inflation?
Yeah, you would hope, but we've part of the reason all these numbers are going up is because we've received an even bigger bump in the consumer price index over the last 12 months. It's been 3.9%, and several people would say, well, my own personal inflation rate has been much higher than that. Wages have not gone up as much as that. Also in 2012, we don't know for sure if this is going to be true, but there is going to be an expiration of the Social Security tax break that was put in, so people will be automatically not only paying more in Social Security taxes than they were in 2011, but the base on which Social Security taxes are billed is going to rise as well. So people who make more than, say, about $107,000 will see an increase in their Social Security taxes. And finally, even these beneficiaries, especially retirees, who are going to get a higher check come January 1st, Medicare premiums, which are deducted from the Social Security retirement check usually, are also going to be up, going up with inflation. So most of that increase is going to be eaten up by the higher Medicare premiums. So the good news is it'll keep pace, but the bad news is you're going to pay a higher cost, so it'll end up being just about a wash.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We'll take more calls for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Dennis in Eau Claire. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Joy. Hey, Kevin. A question that I don't hear you talk about much, and that's tax-free municipal bonds. I'm just curious if there's a really better conservative.
I'm sorry, it's kind of a fuzzy connection. What are your thoughts on tax-free municipal bonds, Kevin?
I like them for the right people in the right situation. They generally have to be people who already are in a very high income tax bracket or expect to be in the near future or expect that tax rates in general will be going up a lot. There are risks to them that generally aren't thought of. They sound like bonds. Municipal bonds sound like safe investments, and usually they have been. The problem is more municipalities run into financial difficulties, whether it's because of lower revenue or higher cost. It makes it more difficult for them to pay off their bonds, and we haven't seen a huge range of concerns recently, but there are some isolated stories of municipalities actually defaulting on their bonds because it's much easier to default on a bond issue than it is to raise taxes or cut services for local politicians. So municipal bonds are a pretty good deal if you understand the risks involved. They can fly around like crazy according to interest rates, according to the economy, and according to tax legislation. But generally, I like them as a part of a portfolio, obviously outside of retirement plans, but more as a complement. I'd actually, if someone said, I'm either going to buy like a high yield bond, like a junk bond or mutual fund, or I'm going to put it into a municipal tax-free bond or mutual fund, I'd probably almost rather have them, if they're in the very high tax bracket and high income bracket, that I'd almost rather have them look at the tax-free bond because they're probably more likely to have a higher net after-tax yield relative to the risk that they're taking. But I don't think they're perfect, but they're pretty good.
Coming up, Kevin McKinley will shed some light on the topic of light bulbs and changes in light bulbs, and we'll take more of your calls. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mr. Blue Sky, please tell us why you had to hide away for so long.
Well, that's the Electric Light Orchestra, Mr. Blue Sky, playing it in honor of our shop around topic on light bulbs. And apparently we have some changes in the types of light bulbs that will be available to us. And we also have daylight saving time ending on November the 6th. So let's shed some light on this for us, Kevin.
Well, there's a joke about how many scientists does it take to change a light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently more than what we currently have right now, because the light bulb has not changed for several decades since Thomas Edison perfected it in October 132 years ago. There have been very few advancements since then, but one big change to consumers anyway is going to come after January 1st in that there will be no new incandescent 100-watt bulbs sold. And other wattages besides the 100-watt will be phased out over the coming years, I think through 2015. This is due to legislation that was passed way back in 2007.
This is to encourage more use of the compact fluorescent light bulbs?
That's right. About 90% of energy in a traditional bulb goes to heat, not light, which unless you're really destitute and trying to cook over your light bulb, which then light bulbs and cost aren't your biggest concern, they're not as efficient as the CFLs would be. And CFL usage, which has actually come more to the forefront in the last couple of years, it's actually down over the last few years because of the cost and because of issues of disposability but with the mercury contamination or whatever. And some people don't like them because they take a little time to, that half a second or whatever before the light comes on that bugs them, so they stick with the cheaper version as well. But still, the CFLs have much lower energy use, generally about $6 in less energy per year. So you typically make up the cost of a CFL in about 6 months to a year versus a traditional incandescent bulb. And in the last year or so, safer models have become available, which have, any mercury is contained within a coating. But you can go to epa.gov/CFL to get some of the ins and outs of buying and disposing of CFLs. But keep in mind, the cost is made up within about a year, and the lifespan of a traditional CFL is about 8 to 15 years. Now, several people say, I had one and it went broke the first day. Well, take it back, because generally those have a 90-day to 180-day warranty, and even then, don't give up yet, because there might be an even newer, better standard coming down the pike very soon.
What's the latest technology on that?
These are LED bulbs, light-emitting diodes, that have a 15-year life expectancy. They are immediately on, and there is no mercury contained in most of them. They do get extremely hot, and they're not widely available right now. And if they are available, it's only in the lower wattages, like a 40 to 60-watt equivalent, and they cost a lot. They cost about $30 to $40 in many cases. But Consumer Reports did a huge test on this, found that the Philips Ambient LED was their favorite bulb, with the 12.5-watt version, no mercury in it. It costs about $25 to $30 at the discount stores.
Yeah. So, Kevin, clarify for me. Starting January 1, the 100-watt incandescent bulbs are no longer going to be for sale, but I can still get a 60-watt.
Yeah, and you will be for a while. This is one of many products that for people who aren't, comfortable or have enough assets to invest in traditional types of stocks and bonds and mutual funds, you can start buying your own 100-watt light bulbs and hoarding them. You could also pick up ketchup packets. They're going to do away with those in the year. Primatine mist, that's being wiped out at the end of the year as well. So you can store up on your own little basket of goods that won't be available after the first year and see if you can make a buck that way.
And with daylight savings time coming, are you looking forward to falling back? I have to admit, I'm not a huge fan.
Is it spring back? Fall forward.
No,
fall
I thought it was spring ahead and fall
April
back.
April hath 30 days. God, I can never remember.
I think
these.
I just lose sleep, and I don't like that.
It's really sad. I'm at both an age and stage in my life where that extra hour of sleep is almost as good as Christmas. I mean, it's just like, oh, thank you. I get to move the clock back. I get an extra hour of sleep. It's a great holiday. We should be having parades, but I don't want to wake up in time to go see it. So I'll just cherish that extra hour of sleep.
We will complain about that another time. Kevin McKinley is here. We have time now to answer more of your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Helen in Fond du Lac is with us next. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Hi.
Fine. Hi. My question is, I'd like to have Kevin's opinion on buying a life insurance policy as part of estate planning. In other words, it'd be a lump sum, and at, like, for example, $100,000 lump sum, and at death, my beneficiaries would receive around $180,000, $190,000. Is that a good idea for a 79-year-old woman?
I actually, and shockingly, Helen, I don't think it's the worst idea in the world. And many times life insurance products, partially because they carry a large commission for the seller, are oversold, and many of the ideas don't really pass muster once you weigh out the cost and benefits. I don't mind this for several reasons, one of which is that $180,000 is tax-free. Generally, we'll skip probate because there will be a beneficiary on the life insurance policy. And as long as the life insurance company is in business, you, your heirs will get that money. And you can technically get some access to that money. It's very difficult to get at it in its full force immediately. And for people who say, well, I want to have this as an investment to use while I'm alive, it generally takes 15 to 20 years for most of these cash value type policies to earn enough to offset the higher expenses and the sales commissions involved with them. If it's not a significant portion of your assets, meaning if you, the $100,000 were to disappear from your net worth and it wouldn't cause you a significant issue, I would consider it. If you think that there's a decent chance that you might not be around in the next 5 or 10 years, I would consider it. And finally, if it's an insurance company which you think will be around long after you're gone, I would consider it. It's not something I would jump to immediately, but it's not something I would dismiss out of hand. So I would definitely keep it on your plate, Helen.
Okay. I was thinking of doing this because of the volatility of stocks and bonds and so on. And that's why I thought, because I do have a pension and I don't need this to live on. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I thought I would do that, to have increase the money I could leave.
Yep, I would. We'll put this link up to this website, Helen, at onyourmoney.com. But the Consumer Federation of America has a little offshoot service where, for about, well, I think it's maybe about $50 or $100, a guy will evaluate this life insurance policy and tell you if it's a good one or not, if you can do better someplace else. And it's a little harder to tell if it's right for your situation because there's more gray to it. But again, we'll put that link up, and we'll. I would suggest that you get the particulars on the policy and then hand it over to that service. And just for, it's a relatively low cost to get a second opinion on the policy itself and the ins and outs and how it might apply to you.
Okay, fine.
All right. Thank you for calling, Helen. Our next caller is Kathy in Marshfield. Hello, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for the program. I've been getting more and more information about donations to bona fide charities like the Nature Conservancy and the National Parks, where they want you to give a big lump sum of money where you get the tax deduction, and then they will pay you a high rate of interest. Like at my age, it's usually around 6%. You know, playing on if you live long enough, you'll get your money back, and if you don't, they automatically recoup whatever is left. Is that a good thing? I mean, sometimes it seems so too good to be true to be getting 6% interest on your money.
It is too good to be true to the sense that that you're not really getting 6% on your money. You might getting an income stream that represents 6% of what you give them, meaning let's say you give them $10,000 and you'll get $50 a month or $600 a year. The problem with that is you can't get your $10,000 back no matter how hard you try. And if something happens to what this is known as typically a charitable gift annuity, if something happens to the assets underneath, which can happen in isolated circumstances, your income stream might stop. And so it's only as good as the claims paying ability of the underlying assets, not of the nonprofit, but of the isolated charitable gift annuity account. But that said, it's a smart way to give. If you do want some income, you do get a tax deduction up front, and even that income stream, as high as it may be, a lot of that, especially for older people, comes back to you as a return of principal, so it's tax-free. So you'll up your income quite a bit than what you currently have. You'll get a tax deduction upon the initial deposit, and your tax bill from that income stream will probably not go very much at all. So in certain cases, it can be a really neat deal, but I would definitely check out the claims-paying ability of the charitable gift annuity organization underlying and see what their strengths are. And there's actually, again, another website we'll have up at onyourmoney.com on the American, I think it's American Council of Gift Annuities, has plenty of information for both charitable organizations and for individual givers. So I wouldn't, again, I wouldn't dismiss it. It's not probably as good as a CD, obviously, but if you already want to help the organization in question, it can be a really good way to help them out, get a nice tax break, and get some income back. And, you know, one of the things to point out is if you're not around, it won't matter to you in particular if the income stream stops, and so it won't be an issue.
All right.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kathy. I think we have time for one more call. Gordon in Waukesha. Hello, Gordon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for the opportunity to ask this question. This summer, I authorized the transfer of an IRA, a matured IRA CD with Bank of America, to another custodian, and the transfer occurred on time, and it was made. I recently received my third quarter statement from Bank of America. It's a periodic quarterly statement that all savings institutions issue, and I noticed that they arbitrarily deducted a $50 service fee from the transfer amount before it was made, and I'm wondering who I can complain to. I thought about the FDIC or my politicians, the state. I'm just curious, where could I get some action about protesting this arbitrary withdrawal?
Right here. You've come to the right place, Gordon. Let's march on that giant corporation. The bad news is it probably wasn't arbitrary. Chances are it was in some buried in some prospectus or notice that you, oh, let's not say you received, let's say it was sent to you, and they put that in there, and it could even have been there when you signed up on the account. These are actually very common, and because people don't close accounts every single month and transfer to new ones, they don't experience this, but it's probably in the terms of their agreement. What often happens, I'll give you a good example. With our firm, when someone transfers their assets into for us to work with, and they incur this kind of fee, we reimburse them for the fee, not because there's something wrong with it or whatever. We just think it's good business practice, and people get really annoyed by these fees. It's one more profit generator for the institutions, but it's not just Bank of America. It's not even just large institutions. Many small banks or credit unions might charge that as well. They'll say it's to make up, you know, the costs of moving it around. But typically, you know, this is Barb in accounting does six keystrokes and the money's transferred, so I can't believe it costs $50 for her to do it. But it's what they charge. There's really no way around it. What you may be able to do is contact whoever received the money and say, hey, I incurred this fee from transferring from them to you. Is there a way that you can offset this fee or give me a credit for it so I don't have to pay it?
Thanks, Gordon, for the call. Good luck to you. Time for the website of the week, Kevin?
Yeah, it's the aforementioned consumerreports.org, and I think it's good to talk about organizations like the Green Bay Packers and Consumer Reports on Wisconsin Public Radio. These are generally user-supported organizations, and the money's not going to some big owner in the sky, but Consumer Reports is celebrating their 75th anniversary of testing products. In that time, they've tested 155,000 products. If you like all the information on Your Money, but you don't appreciate the humor, and there are actually several people out there who've expressed that concern to me. You'll really like Consumer Reports. So go to consumerreports.org. It's about $30 for a subscription to the magazine, but there are several free sources of information on that as well, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com. later on today.
Kevin, it's been another illuminating edition of On Your Money.
You light up my life.
Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Thank you. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Hey, tomorrow at this time, we will talk with a longtime NPR personality, Bob Edwards. We'll talk about his new book, Voice in the Box, tomorrow between 8 and 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.